Okay, so this is sort of a group talk where we'll take turns. I'll start off and then it'll be Dominique, Rita, and Esteban. And the goal of this talk is to go over some of the concepts we have covered so far in the geochemistry lecture, reiterate some of the important concepts, and then also present some new ideas and hopefully tie it all back together at the end. So we also want this to be interactive just to make sure that information is percolating, you know, correctly through. And to start off, this is a pretty picture of an ocean island, just to remind everybody what geochemists do. We like working on plumes because they allow us to go to fantastic places. The downside is, as Dominique showed, you have to work with a lot of acids as well. The way that I kind of think about geochemistry is that it presents you with the time-integrated information. So when you're looking at seismology, it's a snapshot of the modern day. You can then model those seismic observations with geodynamic models. And then to test those geodynamic models, you could think of using the geochemistry, which is basically giving you the full history of the Earth. So just to start off with, I'm going to ask the question to the audience, what is a nucleosynthetic anomaly? that's a great start, yeah. Any other better answer? So we also actually need the answers to flow, otherwise we'll be here kind of late. So this, yeah.
Different than what you'd expect from maybe nuclear physics, the production rate of some element.
Sure.
So, like, if your synthetic actually make all different isotopes, so anomaly maybe represents their different isotopic signature, or different reservoirs, like the meteorites and the silicate Earth itself.
Yeah. Go ahead and say that again.
So the nuclear synthesis is actually the process that you make different isotopes for the whole, maybe the solar system. And the anomaly actually represents that we have different isotopic composition for different reservoirs, like the different meteorites and the Earth itself. So because generally, we think the primary meteorites is the building block of the silicate Earth. If that's not the case, or maybe we have a nucleosynthetic anomaly, then the meteorites have a different isotopic signature compared with the silicate Earth or the bulk Earth.
So that's a great answer. So one way that I tend to think of this is that these are isotopic anomalies that are made in stars, and effectively you're looking at deviations in isotopic composition with respect to some bulk composition, where the bulk composition is basically the bulk composition of the solar system, or maybe it's the bulk composition of the Earth. So the reference point is also kind of important. But again, one way to think about it is that these are anomalies made by S process and R process nucleosynthesis that Dominique talked about. S process is the slow neutron capture, happens in AGB stars, and R process is basically associated with supernovas. So basically it means that there is a deviation from, let's say, the bulk composition of the Earth, or there's a deviation from the composition of certain meteorites. So it's with respect to some reference frame. And it's important to define that reference frame. Okay. Some more even basic questions. Hopefully these are slowly sinking in if you've never seen isotopes. What is the difference between a radioactive and a radiogenic isotope? Go for it.
I'm gonna try. Radioactive decays and produces daughter products, right? And radiogenic is like a daughter.
That's right. So radioactive decays, perfect, fantastic. What is the difference between a stable isotope and a radiogenic isotope?
Thank you. a stable isotope doesn't decay and a radiogenic isotope was formed by decay? No.
So a stable isotope does not decay. A radiogenic isotope is formed by radioactive decay, but a radiogenic isotope could be a stable isotope. Okay. Because this daughter product, so this decay product, is usually stable. Okay. And in some cases, the radiogenic isotope may not be stable itself. And then what is a non-radiogenic isotope? Again, we're looking at the students.
It is not affected by radioactive decay.
Yeah, it's an isotope that is not produced by radioactive decay. So for example, if you are now looking at these non-radiogenic isotopes in meteorites and you're seeing big differences in the isotopic composition, how would you interpret that signature? You cannot interpret that signature as a product of radioactive decay, right? So how would you then interpret it? Right? So that's how you may want to think about it. If you're seeing these non-radiogenic isotopes showing variations in meteorites, showing variations between meteorites and Earth, you're basically looking at signatures that were produced in the stars and incorporated in to growing planetesimals and planetary embryos. Bruce?
We haven't really talked very much about cosmogenic effects. Maybe aren't disturbed radioactive decay, but can be produced by universes.
So that is true. So there is cosmic ray produced spallation isotopes. And so usually we tend to try and correct those out to look for things either for radioactive decay or for these non-radiogenic isotopes. And one great example is actually tungsten. Tungsten has a cosmogenic signal that needs to be corrected for. Okay. So this was the terminology that I had introduced. And again, just a reiteration of what we had talked about, decay. This decays, this is the decay product, and the non-radiogenic isotopes are not affected by decay. So now let's go back to this idea of the bulk silicate earth composition. This is a really busy table. I don't expect you to kind of look at all of the numbers. But I basically wanted to make a couple of points on this slide. So here is a carbonaceous chondrite composition. These four compositions are basically made are derived from this chondritic earth model. This is a non-chondritic earth model. So ignore this column for the time being, and let's look at just the first three or four elements. When you look at these chondritic earth models, what do you see in terms of their major element chemistry? They're about the same, right? Not a huge difference. What about the difference between these group of chondritic models and the non-chondritic models? Would you be able to distinguish between these models based on any kind of seismic observations? No, right? So this is an important thing to keep in mind, that when we're talking about whether you have a chondritic earth model or a non-chondritic earth model, there are very subtle differences in their major element chemistries. There are much bigger implications when we talk about minor elements or trace elements. Okay. And then there is one group of model, which is this enstatite chondrite model, which basically argues that the Earth was made out of enstatite chondrites. And now if you look at the first four elements, what do you think? It is starting to look quite distinct, right? And maybe this is something that could be picked up seismologically. And more importantly, this is the composition of the bulk silicate earth, and this is about 6 weight percent more silica in the bulk silicate earth. And it turns out you have to actually put most of this excess silica in the lower mantle. You cannot put it in the upper mantle because we know where basalts are made from. They're made from material that is melting in the upper mantle. you cannot have this amount of silica in the upper mantle. Your basalts will look very, very different. So instead, what you need to do is you need to have a silica-enriched lower mantle. Okay. So again, there are very important consequences for this enstatite chondrite model. This is one of the things that Ved was talking about as almost being a perennial CIDR project in terms of looking at the bulk compositions. Christine.
You have to take the pyrolytic upper mantle out of that.
That's right.
Actually, you end up with free silica.
That's right, yeah. It
and that's way more sensitive.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've done a little bit on this.
Yeah, so this one, I think, does have predictions that can be tested with seismological signals. And before I move on to the next slide, again, do people remember what a chondritic earth model is based on? Because if you look at a CI chondrite, the CI chondrite looks nothing like the chondritic earth models, right, in their major element chemistry. So again, do people remember what this chondritic, which is why I put it in quotes, is really referring to? I heard ratios being whispered somewhere there, which is on the right track, yeah? So again, remember, the chondritic earth model means that the earth has the same refractory element ratios as CI chondrites, meaning it might have the same calcium-titanium ratios as a CI chondrite, not the absolute abundance. And then we use the mantle perturbites to get the absolute abundances. Okay. So again, this is the key reason whether you have a non-chondritic earth model or a chondritic earth model, it doesn't end up affecting the major elements, because even these non-chondritic earth models base their bulk silicate earth compositions on observations of mantle perturbites or mantle-derived melts. Okay. Where the differences come in are in things like uranium, thorium, and potassium. And so here is a set of models associated with the chondritic earth models, and notice that these would give you somewhere between 17 and 20 ppb uranium, between 190 and maybe 260 ppm potassium. And that generates somewhere between 16 and maybe 20 terawatts of heat. In the non-chondritic earth models, you can basically go down to about 10 terawatts to maybe about 14 terawatts. And again, potassium contents of 130 to maybe 160 ppm. And then the enstatite chondrite model likewise has low heat-producing elements, including potassium. So a bunch of you did the potassium argon tutorial yesterday, and hopefully you saw the effect that the potassium budget has on the argon budget of the Earth. So again, remember, the beauty of the argon system is that at the start of the solar system, there was effectively no argon-40. All of the argon-40 that you see on the Earth is basically generated by radioactive decay of potassium. And the reason why we know this is because meteorites have a ratio of 40 over 36. That's about 10 to the negative 4. Whereas even the least radiogenic reservoir, which is the atmosphere, has a ratio of about 300, so 6 orders of magnitude. So that's why all of the argon-40 is a decay product. And so you played with this mass balance, where if you know the bulk silicate earth potassium content, you can figure out how much argon-40 is in the mantle. And turns out, if it's about 260 ppm, which was, and so this argument was very nicely laid out by Claude Allègue in this 1996 paper, that only half of that argon-40 produced would be in the atmosphere. There isn't enough in the MORP source, and so you effectively need to have a undegassed lower mantle. And so this is one of those keystones of having a layering at about the 660, right? And what you notice is, people that did the tutorial, at what point was there no missing argon-40 if you added up what's in the atmosphere with what was in the upper mantle? Roughly what amount of potassium was required to do that?
150.
About 150. The non-chondritic earth model, right? So the non-chondritic earth models effectively make this layering go away. If you have potassium content in the solid earth, in this bulk silicate earth, that's around 240 to 260 ppm, hopefully what you would see is it's very, very difficult not to have some degree of layering.
Sorry. Yeah, one question and maybe one comment. So the question is, so do we expect potassium to be volatile during accretion and actually be lost? And the comment is, an alternative explanation is, if you have a basal-mag motion that is relatively thick, and then potassium is incompatible and then would end up in, well, a deep enriched layer like a LLSVP or something, if LLSVP is a basal magma ocean cumulate, then you also can reconcile this missing argon paradox with whole metal convection.
Okay, so let me answer the first part, which was about volatility. So yes, potassium is volatile, and we think not in terms of potassium lost from the Earth, but that it never was accreted to begin with. It's very hard to lose potassium from the Earth once you get it. So what people played around in the tutorial is kind of shown in this figure, where if you have crust ocean atmosphere, which is half of the argon-40, and if you have a 95% MORP source and a 5% OIB source, with this 5% basically being your LLSVP volume, this really works if you are at a potassium content that's roughly below 200 ppm. The moment you start going above 200 ppm, I think what people were noticing was that you had to put a lot of potassium into this tiny volume. And so then you can calculate the radiogenic heat production. So for example, let's say you have 260 ppm potassium, you would end up with something that is on the order of 2,600 ppm potassium in this. And likewise, something like maybe 150 ppb of uranium to 200 ppb uranium. So it's going to be really hot. And so those are interesting calculations to do in terms of the mass balances, right? And so really, if the potassium content goes above 200 ppb, it really becomes hard to have a picture like this where it's 95% MORP source with 5% LLSVPs being the OIB source. You want, or you need to kind of make this a little bit bigger. And higher the potassium content, kind of bigger this reservoir needs to be. And so this is the key reason why we need to pay attention to how the Earth formed and what the bulk composition of the Earth was.
Okay. So you were talking about these different chondrite models and how essentially there isn't one particular meteorite that fits the Earth, essentially. And since we also talked about the moon coming from the Earth, if you made a model of, let's say, bulk silicate moon plus bulk silicate Earth, would that fit any of the chondrite models better?
No, so the moon is depleted in potassium, and that's because potassium didn't condense from the disk from which the moon was forming. Most of that potassium came back to the Earth. The potassium content of the bulk silicate Earth is determined not based on lunar observations. It's basically made based on Ku ratios in the bulk silicate Earth and then the uranium content of bulk silicate Earth. And the uranium content is whether it's the non-chondritic Earth model or whether it's the chondritic Earth model. Okay, so that's what's driving it. Okay, so I don't want to go into too much detail, but by now, again, hopefully some of these concepts might be sinking in. So, and Dominique is going to talk more about this. So this is showing you, again, the basic difference between the long-lived radioactive system and the extinct radioactive system. So the top is the long-lived system. So this is the radioactive parent, decays to produce the daughter. And so the daughter today is some initial amount plus the radioactive parent times E lambda T minus 1. And then you divide by this non-radiogenic isotope, because mass spectrometers like measuring isotopes more than the absolute abundances. And so this is what we measure. And then from that, we derive the initial and time with extinct radionuclides. Again, remember, all of this is converted. So the daughter today is the daughter initial plus the parent. There is no time information in this case. And instead, what we do is we multiply this parent by a non-radiogenic isotope of this parent, which we call PS. And again, this is the equation of a straight line. So that's your Y. That's your X. And again, what we derive is the initial isotopic ratio and then the ratio of the radioactive parent to its non-radiogenic isotope. And so in this case, this is the fossil isochron. So this is your tungsten isotopic ratio against the hafnium tungsten. So none of these are radioactive. These are both non-radiogenic isotopes. So notice what the time evolution does. Depending upon the hafnium tungsten ratio, it just moves vertically up. Okay? And this hafnium 180 is basically a proxy for this 182 hafnium, which is the extinct radionuclide. So the more hafnium 180 you have, the more hafnium 182 you will have. And so if you have more of this, you will move up further. And so in this context, these are three different reservoirs. This could be bulk silicate earth, or this could be bulk earth. This is bulk silicate earth. This could be core. This could be also different mineral phases in your rock. So again, these different compositions could be minerals or could be big reservoirs, depending upon what you're looking at. And in contrast, this is the long-lived system. This is the radiogenic isotopic ratios. This is the radiogenic daughter, non-radiogenic stable isotope, parent to daughter ratio. And in this case, because this is still alive, it basically decays to this, and you get this one is, or you get a negative one line. And again, these could be your different minerals, or these could be your different reservoirs. So this could be, for example, bulk silicate earth. This could be crust. This could be mantle, and so on, depending upon which isotopic system you're looking at. Okay, and again, the slope is giving you time. So in the extinct radionuclides, the slope again gives you the ratio. So if I just go back for a second, it gives you the ratio of the extinct nuclide to the non-radiogenic isotope, and then you get time by relating these ratios through the radioactive decay equation. Okay, and again, we have some kind of a reference point. So if this is my reference point in terms of an epsilon or a mu, would this be positive or negative again? Quick question. If this is my reference point, is this positive or is this negative? So if this is my standard, or if this is, let's say this is bulk earth and this is bulk silicate earth, if bulk silicate earth plots here, would I call its tungsten isotope ratio positive or negative with respect to bulk earth? Positive, we would call it exactly. So in terms of this epsilon or mu notation that I talked about, this would be positive, and this would be a negative mu or epsilon notation. Okay. Okay. So Dominic is again going to talk more about this long-lived system, but we can make some analogies even with the short-lived system. So imagine you have a chunk of mantle that partially melts, and this is your melt, which is the crust, and this is the residue, which is the depleted mantle. And different elements are going to partition in these two as a function of partition coefficients. So Crystal gave a very nice lecture yesterday. So if you look at, for example, rubidium strontium that's in the mantle, rubidium prefers the melt over the strontium, whereas for samarium neodymium, it's really samarium that is left behind in the mantle preferentially compared to neodymium. So these two systems are kind of opposite in terms of their behavior. So again, quick reminder that rubidium decays to 87 strontium and samarium 147 decays to 143 neodymium. So in terms of an evolution, this is what maybe the system would look like. So I'm plotting time on the x-axis against the strontium isotope ratio. And this is the evolution of the bulk earth. And let's say the bulk earth or the bulk silicate earth partially melts at some point. Because the melt or the crust has a higher rubidium strontium ratio than the bulk earth, it evolves to something with a higher 87-86 ratio. So this evolves to more radiogenic ratio. And likewise, the residue, because it has a lower rubidium strontium than the bulk silicate earth, it evolves to a less radiogenic ratio. Okay. And what happens for neodymium? It's exactly flipped, right? And that's because samarium is preferentially held back in the residue of melting, meaning in the mantle. So the mantle becomes more radiogenic compared to bulk silicate earth. So if you're looking at a relation between rubidium strontium isotopes and neodymium isotopes, what is your general expectation in terms of a correlation? That they should be negatively correlated because the behavior of the parent-daughter systems are exactly different. And what happens if this is an extinct radionuclide? How would this evolution look? it would basically truncate it at some point, depending upon when the parent became extinct. Okay. And also notice that I can mix the crust and the residue together and get back bulk silicate Earth. Right. So for these long-lived systems, they basically continuously evolve from time zero to modern day, whereas for the extinct radionuclides, it would truncate them. And then the only way to get back to bulk silicate Earth compositions for the extinct radionuclides would be to have complete mixing between these products of melting and the residual products. Okay. So this comes back to this question of the neodymium-142. Now we're looking at the extinct system, 146 samarium decaying to 142 neodymium. And I want the students to come up with at least two hypotheses on how to explain this offset between the mantle, terrestrial mantle, and the meteorites, this 0.2 epsilon or 20 ppm difference. So what are two ways of doing this? It's creeping up on lunchtime already, so. Go ahead.
If you have an anomaly, like you were talking about at the beginning, does that mean it's a nucleosynthetic?
So one possibility is that the Earth and the meteorites are starting at a different isotopic composition of 142 over 144. They're not starting at the same point. That's right. What's another interpretation?
There might be another reservoir with a lower epsilon 142 neodymium composition.
So one is that there is another reservoir with lower 142. So now let's go back and quickly look at this. So notice if I do it in terms of an epsilon notation, the crust would be negative with respect to bulk silicate Earth, and the residue would be positive, right? So basically, if you can think of this as this is where bulk silicate Earth was, this is the residue, and then there is some kind of a melt product up here that is hidden. And so here is one class of non-chondritic Earth models that have said this product of melting has been blasted away to space. So the Earth might have started off with chondritic ratios for refractory elements, but those refractory elements got fractionated during partial melting, and then the product of melting was lost to space associated with impacts. Later on, we can talk about the general feasibility of those kinds of ideas. So that's certainly one way of doing it. And then the other way of thinking about this is that the Earth had more samarium compared to neodymium with respect to the chondrites. So that means there's just been more of this product on Earth, so you generated more 142, and you moved the Earth over to the right compared to the meteorites. And again, this is a second class of non-chondritic Earth models because you're saying that samarium and neodymium is not the same in the chondrites versus Earth. Okay. So that's the two models. Earth and chondrite, chondritic meteorites have different initials. Silicate mantle could have a higher samarium neodymium than chondrites, or they could have started with the same samarium neodymium and then it got changed associated with erosion of the crust associated with impacts. And so if this is true, then it really leads to this much lower compositions of, or much lower abundances of heat-producing elements on the Earth. Because if you deplete samarium, you would also be depleting potassium and uranium as well on the Earth. Okay. So that's why you need to pay attention to this in terms of its implications for the bulk silicate Earth. And again, the major changes are going to be in the minor elements. Okay. Now, one of the things I did talk about is that in recent years, in the past couple of years, there's actually now much more sophisticated measurements being made that has really challenged. So even if you went 5 years back, it seemed like this is where the needle was shifting. The silicate mantle had a different SMND ratios. But now these measurements of things like molybdenum isotopes, these are non-radiogenic isotopes, 148 neodymium, non-radiogenic isotopes. So variations of these are basically a product of incomplete mixing of nucleosynthetic anomalies in the solar system. And so what you see is that the Earth is up here, the instatite chondrites are up there, the ordinary chondrites are up there, and you have kind of a mixing line with the Earth and one end of this mixing line. So again, clear evidence that the solar system was not homogeneous in the isotopic compositions of neodymium, molybdenum, and so on. So the key point from this is that this difference, this difference in the neodymium does not have to be related to SMND. It could be very well related to 142, 144 being different for Earth and meteorites. That doesn't actually, though, still completely obviate the need that the SMND ratio could have been higher for the Earth as well. So they're not entirely, or they're not mutually exclusive explanations. Questions?
Thank you. So that slide you just had on the last one, the last slide, it was like from 2005.
That's right.
Has there been a lot more new data? Because if that's true, wouldn't you expect more of a scatter?
Yes, so there is a lot more data. And so here is what I'm showing in terms of, this is a paper from 2017. And one of the things you would notice is that there's hardly any enstatite chondrites that have been measured here. So effectively what has happened is there's a whole lot more measurements of carbonaceous chondrites, ordinary chondrites, enstatite chondrites, and associated with these other measurements which are not affected by radioactive decay. So this 142 is affected by radioactive decay, but it is also affected by nucleosynthetic anomalies in terms of incomplete mixing of products of stellar burning. And the fact that you see this correlation hints to the fact that Earth and the meteorites are not starting at the same point. So you can't take the offset as an indication of early differentiation or differences in SMND, Dominique.
Well, I just want to add that to get one of these measurements, it takes 36 hours of analysis. We are really at the limit of what the instruments can measure. And there are a lot of discussions because you can just produce crap if you're not careful.
Yes.
It's so very, very tedious. So first, the samples are not very common. But second, the analyses are. I wouldn't want to do it. Let's put it that way. And I'm a careful analyst.
So one thing to point out, for example, is this is not a single measurement. This is basically showing you the mean value and the standard deviation of a whole bunch of different enstatite chondrites and likewise for ordinary chondrites and so on. And so I wanted to end with this concept of the Earth being heterogeneous from the get-go, because again, it's useful to think about what early Earth looked like if we really want to figure out how we got to the modern day world. And so again, these are isotopes of tungsten produced from decay of 182 hafnium. So the system is extinct after 60 million years, start of the solar system. So basically a way to think about it is hafnium become extinct as the moon forms. These are measurements from Ishua, about 3.8 billion year old. And the bulk silicate Earth is basically at zero. And effectively, these observations show that these crustal rocks were derived from a reservoir with about a plus 20 ppm difference, meaning this came from a higher hafnium tungsten reservoir compared to bulk silicate Earth. And this is interpreted as a signature of core formation. So the fact that you see this at 3.8 means that this anomaly was produced prior to 60 million years, and the mantle hadn't homogenized it by 3.8, okay? And it's plus 20 ppm. Let's move forward 2.8 billion years, and you still see positive anomalies at 2.8 billion years in tungsten. And you move all the way to modern rocks. So these are rocks that are coming out of the mantle today. And you see anomalies that are somewhere between maybe 20 and 40 ppm positive. So an incredible observation is that the positive anomaly is not diminishing over time. It is staying constant. So even though that isotopic anomaly was produced prior to 60 million years of the start of the solar system, the anomaly hasn't changed. So one big implication of this is that you're not mixing this material with stuff that's on this side and pulling it back towards bulk silicate Earth. This is basically retaining its anomaly almost all the way through 4.5 billion years. And then again, in modern day rocks, we are finding a negative anomaly. And for the timing, I don't want to talk about how we interpret this, But again, it's useful to think about the fact that this was produced 60 million years prior to the, or 60 million years or within 60 million years of the start of the solar system. And modern day rocks are sampling this anomaly. So you had preserved this all the way through Earth's accretion, through the formation of the moon associated with the giant impact, meaning that that impact didn't completely stir and homogenize and mix everything away. So this is both interesting because it's telling us that we can tease out what early Earth might have looked like by making measurements in modern day basalts, as well as providing first order constraints on heterogeneity on the early Earth and the degree of homogenization between different reservoirs as a function of time. And so I'll move to Dominique.
So I'm going to shorten. Sorry, guys. I want to come back to the periodic table. Can you hear me? And I'd like you to look at, again, we saw that, but now that you have heard various things, and look at the distribution of the elements we're looking at. For instance, Sujal talked about the decay of samarium into neodymium. We have these two rare earths that behave very much the same. We have also the decay of hafnium into lutetium. These are different parents, but we end up with daughters that are rare earths. Now they're going to behave slightly differently because the heavy rare earths are way more compatible than the light rare earths. But let's get you involved a little and that will do the job. Let's start with something simple that is not the deep mantle, and let's say you want to study the crust, modern crust. Which isotopes will you use? Which isotopic system? We'll go look at tungsten? No. So what will you use? Rubidium, strontium. Rubidium is a very lithophile element. It's concentrated in the crust, so you're going to see very big variation. Now, you want to go study the core. Which elements are you going to focus on? Yeah, why? Yes. So those are the elements that potentially will have followed iron into the core. And then you want to study the mantle, you left with quite a few, except that if you remember the concentration ratios, the mantle is basically olivine. And what is following magnesium into olivine? Which elements? I'm talking about trace elements. Which elements are following olivine, magnesium into olivine? Nickel. What else? Yeah, that's a major element, but correct. What else? I can't hear.
From the lithophile, it looks like it would be calcium, strontium, or barium.
This basically, well, you're going to have a little bit of chromium, a little bit of cobalt, and that's it. So what I'm getting at is with our tools, we have a little bit of a headache. Most of the mantle rocks are not very rich in some of the key systems that we're using. So keep that in mind, because that's just why we can't take any data to look at anything. You're going to see that goes by itself. You're not going to take surface wave to look at the core. But still, it's so we do what we can with what we have. And we could talk longer about this, but I think you get the picture. We're also affected by when we, and I'm going to take the opposite perspective from Sujo. I'm going to start with what we see today and try to go back in time. So to see radioactive decay systems that we can measure today and have a time constraint, we only limit it basically to these guys because of their half-life. If they have a, what's happening if they have a longer half-life? Can we use them? Why not? Yeah, we're not going to be able to measure variations. And there are other systems that have much longer half-life, but we can't measure the difference in between D0 and what has been produced. And we have, if we have a too shorter half-life, they have disappeared. And that allows me to emphasize one point, which is very important in the lead isotopic systematics. For lead, we have two elements, thorium and uranium, that have very comparable behavior. And in any mantle melting, you're going to have thorium-uranium ratio mostly maintained. That leads to three isotopes of the same elements. That's incredibly powerful. The other thing is that uranium-235 has a half-life of about 700 million years. Meaning, do we have a lot left? No, we basically have none left, even if we assume that when the Earth formed, we had the same proportion of 238, 235, we still would have none left. Because it's basically eight half-lives. So what do you think this implies when you see variation in 207 lead? It's old. It's very old. So keep that in mind, and that's why, you know, when you look at the lead evolutions, you always have diagram. So that's the evolution with time. You have diagram like this, with very little variation in the last 2 billion years. So that makes it another argument for a powerful tool. Okay, so you guys have seen this. You calculated how much the volume of a sphere we needed to produce some of these large igneous provinces. The conclusion is that we're involving a big part of the mantle. And what do? We study those products, and the simplest thing today is to go look at oceanic islands. And so that's what we see. And I know you don't like this diagram, and I want to take you through so that now you will like it and understand what's in there. So we have two systems which have different behavior. We have rubidium, a very incompatible element decaying into strontium, which is incompatible, but not as much as rubidium. And we have uranium decaying into lead. Uranium is also very incompatible. The half-life are very different. What observation do you make when you see these diagrams? What is striking? I hear a lot of trends. What else? They radiate from a point. You're making an interpretation when you say that, but it's correct. What else? I wouldn't call it messy, and that's what I'm going to show you. You don't have a gunshot, though. You have some systematics, and they color-coded by islands. If you color-code them by oceans, you don't see any systematics in the oceanic islands, which is not too surprising, but that's another evidence that the oceanic islands must come from the deeper mantle. Because if you color-code these islands by Atlantic, Pacific, and Indian Oceans, you don't have any systematics. What this means is the mantle is heterogeneous, and every single mantle plume sampled by these islands has a different composition. Indeed, and that's the fingerprint here, remember, these ratios have the fingerprint of the source. What does it mean, the fingerprint? If I take your fingerprint, what does that tell me? It's you and it's nobody else. Nobody can transform their fingerprints. Well, you can erase them, but that's then you're going to lose your distinction. But so that's very important. Keep that in mind. So the way we define these we have actually not very many of these names, and I'm going to take you through the acronyms, and then I'm going to make you calculate how we get there. So we have the depleted mantle, that's in blue here, that's the mid-oceanic ridge basalt. Then we have these trends here that define what's called the enriched mantle. Why do you think we call this enriched mantle? Where's the microphone? Compared with a reference, but which reference?
Maybe the MOP or the Boxlegers.
Okay, but so what would you need to go from here to there?
Are you getting
high rubidium strontium ratio. So where are you going to find a high rubidium strontium ratio? In the crust. You got it. So what do you think is our interpretation of the origin of these end member here? Yeah, but we're dealing with mantle plume, so what does that imply? Recycling, indeed. So the interpretation we make is that the mantle plumes, here for instance, I'm getting lost in the colors. Hawaii is here. Yeah, Kerguelen is there in yellow. The mantle plume has sampled some continental crust material or sediments from the continental material in the deep mantle. I mean, all these oceanic islands, and that's why we go on oceanic islands, don't go through crust, so they're not contaminated when they come to the surface. Yes?
Do those arrays end up extending off, and if you were to like put regressions through them, do they end up intersecting? Otherwise, why is it that you don't have, like, why might you have separate arrays?
They all intersect in here.
Sure, but if that's recycled continental crust, like, wouldn't you expect there to be mixing so that you'd have a much broader field as opposed to individual linear arrays?
Can we come back to that at the, when you calculate mixing? So all these arrays, if you indeed make a regression with them, and they're going to be hyperbolas because you have different chemical system, intersect in something that's here, which is, remember this PREMA, prevalent mantle, foso, focal zone, or C. And then we have a bunch, and they are really a bunch, of tiny islands in the Pacific that have these very high lead ratios, but not specially variation in strontium. So what could give you very radiogenic lead ratios? What's the condition? Let's get a geophysicist student answer. What do you need to have very radiogenic lead ratio?
A lot of uranium.
A lot of uranium. Where will you find a lot of uranium?
Hot areas.
Hot areas?
Yeah.
But then you would have high strontium too. High rubidium and then high strontium. What happens if you weathered oceanic crust? You can mobilize a lot of uranium and concentrate it when you do. And so that's how you would end up with this. High mu, the mu is the parent-daughter ratio uranium to lead. Yes.
Raise the microphone.
So with that in mind, though, you're saying that EM is crust, and therefore crust should have high uranium, but it's still EM is still on the left. So then you're saying every one of the data points is somehow enriched in uranium.
It's a very good question. And it comes from the fact that depending, and if you look at the work that Roberta did, if you look at the distribution of uranium in the crust, you see that as you go towards the lower crust, if you have granulate facies, is that what you say? Facies, you know what I mean. You will lose uranium. And so lower crust is less radiogenic than the mantle. Upper crust is way more radiogenic. In that diagram, this would be lower crust. This is upper crust, and this is mantle. No, I don't think so.
I think it does.
In the bulk mantle, but not in the mantle produced in the average evolution there. We can go back to that.
Another question, sorry. So if the interpretation of high mu basalts is that it's a lot of mobilization of uranium through the oxidizing weathering and bringing that into the mantle, so if you were to look at some of these plumes from, let's say, before the great oxidation events, wouldn't ancient, if you have a more ancient source, it would be lower uranium, lower radiogenic lead, and still have the same process?
Yeah, but where are you going to find these plumes that are older than 2.5 billion years?
Well, maybe the OIB source region is sampling ancient subducted crust. Or ancient subducted slabs.
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. So basically, and all this is going to be in the notes. You can
Dominique, I have a question. Can you go back to the previous? What's going on with Cook? Why does Cook sample three of these reservoirs?
Where's Cook?
The red squares.
Oh, Cook is a mess.
Yeah, but why is it a mess?
I don't know.
No. Okay.
I haven't looked up Cook.
Multiple hotspots.
Yeah.
I think it's multiple hotspots that are moving over the same area.
Yeah. So, what I want you to do, and I know it's tough, it's noon, is have a good perspective on what why we call this like that, but also how much material it takes to change, how much recycled material it takes to change a mantle composition. So we have an average mantle, and here the model is if you add oceanic lithosphere, and you can go look at the Stracker paper and look at all the details, oceanic lithosphere and lower continental crust, that's how much you need to change these numbers. You can see that here we only need 6%. That doesn't tell you much. Let's do it. I need all of you to take a piece of paper or your phone, whatever. We'll do a couple of calculations. It's going to go fast, no worry. So we have our mantle source, and we add a component number 2, and the result is your basalt, your oceanic island basalt. And what you see is that each component has its isotopic composition and a given concentration of an element. And then X is the fraction of your component in the melt. So that's very simple. So we have this for strontium, and we have the same for neodymium. What's happening in these diagrams, strontium, neodymium, you have a ratio, and I'll come back to the ratio in a minute, that is dependent. It's the ratio of the strontium neodymium in component 1 compared to the ratio of strontium neodymium in component 2. And depending on that ratio, you change the curvature of the curve. And it would be the same if I have strontium and lead here. Huh? It's different chemical element. Remember, in lead, your mixing is a straight line because you have the same chemical elements. So, just for the sake of the exercise, we know that neodymium 144, the daughter product, is directly proportional to the concentration of neodymium. Same thing for strontium, it's directly proportional to the isotope of strontium is directly proportional to the total quantity of strontium. We can just simplify that our ratio is strontium neodymium in component 2 divided by strontium neodymium in component 1. Okay? So I'm going to take an extreme example. Oh, forgot the animation. If we take all the arcs, and that I'm taking this to have a bigger range. So we go from here, mantle, to Atlantic sediments, and we have various arc lavas. You see that altered oceanic crust is also going horizontal. And that's simply because of the mobility of strontium through alteration, while neodymium is not mobile. So anytime you see horizontal variation in this diagram, it shows that you have some alteration. That's a parenthesis. So which lava here, so we have all lavas, which one do you think registered the most sediment input? What's the symbol? The diamond. Now, how do we know if it's sediment or if it's these crustal gneisses that are there? That's where we can calculate our ratios. And you don't need to look at the formulas. So we have possible sedimentary input. We have 807, so please write that down, 807 ppm of strontium and 14 ppm of neodymium. If we take, let's take the highest strontium here, organase. Here are the concentrations, 17 ppm neodymium, 22 ppm strontium. So can you calculate the R ratio and tell me the R ratio here and tell me what you think? So I guess I need to do that in two goes. I'll put the R ratios on the board. And then we have, you can see it here. So we take our least hydrogenic lava, we make the ratio between the lavas and the sediment, and we do the same with the orthognathes. Is it clear what you need to do?
Can you provide the composition of the more least hydrogenic lava?
Here?
I don't know. Okay. It's just in front of me. It's just a different color.
So it's just calculating two ratios. You understand? If you don't, ask a question.
I don't understand. You want us to calculate a ratio between the sediment and the radiogenic matrix lava, and then also the sediment and the crustal canyon?
Yeah, to define what is changing the composition this way. You good? Sorry. So for the sake of time, these are on the wiki. But if you understand the principle, I'll show you the result. This is the result. And so the R ratio for the orthognathes is 0.009, and the R ratio for the sediment is 4.16. It shows you how that ratio affects the shape of the curve. Where am I going with this? It also shows you that we can't simply put everything and anything into the mantle. All our curves in the strontium lead, or you can take other plots, it's going to be the same, are governed by the composition of what's being brought down. The other thing I want to emphasize, we have a mixing proportion here. 10%, you see what it takes if you put 10% sediment into an arc lava, and then here's for the orthognathes. So I hope that by now you're not going to run away from these isotopic diagrams. And I think I should stop here because we're running seriously out of time. Yes.
I feel like yesterday you showed us evidence that the African and the Pacific LSVPs are maybe different.
Yeah.
But you said in the plot you just showed, if you color them by being above African LSVP or Pacific LSVP, you don't see a difference.
The reason why I'm making this statement is the difference between Hawaii and Pitcairn, and I think that's what this is, Hawaii and Pitcairn. So Hawaii is the red dots, Pitcairn is the yellow lozenges. Hawaii and Pitcairn are above the Pacific LLSVP. Kerguelen in orange here is there. Tristan and Gough in brown are there at the extreme ends of the African LLSVP. So the suggestion I made, if the model is correct, that the difference between LOA and KEA is coming from the fact that LOA is sampling the Pacific LLSVP. We expand this idea to Pitcairn, and the material that has been potentially stored at the bottom, I mean, in the Pacific LLSVP, as would define these compositions, while the one under the, I mean, in the African LLSVP is here. And now we can see a little more too, it's potentially older.
So are there no other EM1 islands that sit in the African LLSVP?
No.
So where all those other islands in the African LLSVP sit, do they?
Which other islands? In for instance?
So all those dots in the
Reunion?
Rest of, yeah.
I don't know where Reunion is. Not all the islands have strikingly, I mean, different or things that stand out. Huh? You have a lot that is mixed here.
Dominique, it yes. seems that your example that you showed us worked best when there was only one source of contamination. And so how common is that? If we are being contaminated by continental crust and sediments, for example, I would get some admixture of those two.
Oh, parts. Yeah, then you get this. Good question. If you mix the sediment and the gneiss, you end up in between. But we see that we don't see that very much, because when you look at the distribution of the samples in all the isotope, the binary isotope plots, they're not going everywhere.
Yeah, so what does that mean?
Well, that means that if there is sediment recycled, you really don't need very much to change the composition. And it's really minimum. And that's not too surprising, huh? Because any material that has been at the surface of the Earth has very high concentration in our elements, and so they completely, it doesn't take very much to change the signal. When we do calculation, it's usually between 0 and 1%.
The issue is surface.
Yeah. Well, and then the other issue is, for instance, with high mu. Where is the high mu? We don't all agree where I'm. I don't have a definite answer where high mu is coming from.
Sorry. Oh no. If I had given the tutorial the other day, we wouldn't
Sorry.
Be.
Poor. What do we want to do? Yeah. What do we want to just do it? Okay. I think I can do this quickly. So in an attempt at a smooth transition, let's say this. We all bring our, can you hear me?
Yep.
We're all bringing our different observations and constraints to the table. So I like the way that Sujoy put it, that you have these seismological constraints, and then to explain, oh, thanks. To explain what you're seeing in the seismology, you have geodynamical models that try to reproduce sort of having slabs and maybe upwellings in the mantle, and these geodynamical models then produce geochemical consequences, which can be tested against actual geochemical observations. So this is showing a figure from Balmer et al. 2015, where you're forming mantle heterogeneities continuously and mixing them away continuously. And so in this sort of a mantle, you'd have a mantle that's depleted of its trace elements, and it'd also be extensively depleted of primordial noble gas budgets. And so the constraints that we can place on this type of processing are going to come from your major elements, your trace elements, your isotope ratios. And so what I wanted to do was just give a couple more thoughts on constraints on mantle processing from xenon isotopes, because we haven't really talked too much about xenon, and I think it's a very powerful system for thinking about geodynamics. So when I talked on Saturday, I gave you this timeline and sort of painted out the systems that produce xenon, the radiogenic systems that produce xenon over time. So we can think of xenon in the mantle as a mixture of five potential components. And bear with me, I'll try to keep everything color-coded and as simple as possible. So you have short-lived radioactive iodine-129. And that is going to produce a specific isotope of xenon, xenon-129. It's only produced in the first 90 million years of Earth history. So this is sensitive to processes happening in the early Earth. You have primordial mantle xenon. That was the xenon that was accreted with Earth, as Earth accreted. You have potentially recycling of atmospheric xenon if your subducting slabs are carrying volatiles. If those volatiles are retained beyond depths of magma generation, then you would take atmospheric xenon into the mantle and mix it in. So in your geodynamic model, these slabs that are mixing into the mantle would potentially carry recycled atmospheric xenon. And then over time, you have fission xenon being produced as well. In the first 400 to 500 million years of Earth history, you'd produce plutonium-derived fission xenon. That's a relatively short-lived radioisotope. And then uranium-238 is decaying on long timescales, billion-year timescales, to produce fission xenon as well. And so what we can do is we can say, okay, we can measure the present-day mantle xenon isotopic composition and try to tease apart the signatures by performing a linear least squares minimization, saying these are my five components. They each have a distinct isotopic composition. I have plenty of xenon isotope ratios. I have 9 isotopes, so I can come up with lots of linear equations to try to constrain that mixing. So what if I try to solve for the proportion of xenon from each of these five components that would best explain what we see in the mantle today? And I won't talk too much about this ratio of short-lived iodine-derived xenon to plutonium xenon, but I will talk about the ratio of plutonium to uranium-derived fission xenon, and you'll see why. So if we do this linear least squares minimization, the first order observation that we can see is that the present-day mantle xenon budget is dominated by recycled atmospheric xenon. So this is my rare occasion to present a pie chart at a scientific conference. Xenon-132 from recycled atmosphere in blue, primordial mantle in purple, plutonium fission in yellow, uranium fission in this pink. And these are mid-ocean ridge basalt study areas. What we can see is 80 to 90% of the xenon-132 is coming from recycled atmosphere. And you have something like 5 to 10% primordial mantle, and then some very small amounts of plutonium and uranium fission xenon. Now, if I show study areas that are plume-derived, Iceland and the Rochambeau Rift, that's still the case. You still have dominantly xenon-132 from recycled atmosphere. And what do you notice on this? You can barely see the uranium fission. It's still there. It's just that you have a larger slice of the pie that is plutonium and potentially just a larger budget of xenon overall. Okay, so first order observation, mostly recycled atmospheric xenon. And the thing that's sort of stunning about this is if you look at the neon isotopic composition, the neon isotopic composition of Iceland is the most primitive or the least degas signature that we've seen among different ocean island basalts. So even at that location, 90% of the xenon is recycled atmosphere. And so if you sort of try to absorb that, the picture that it paints is that if you're recycling xenon, potentially you're not recycling neon. So atmospheric neon has not been accompanying this. All right, so takeaway point, even in mantle sources with primitive helium and neon, we have evidence for the incorporation of recycled material. So again, this is hitting home the point that you have to be always aware of which geochemical systems are sensitive to which processes. So if you're looking for recycled signatures, helium and neon may not be the systems you want to focus on because atmospheric neon is not recycled and you barely have atmospheric helium to recycle. So the budgets of the mantle helium and neon are not reflecting recycling as a process, whereas xenon may be more sensitive to that. Okay, so if we know that regassing of xenon from the atmosphere is happening in association with recycling, we can then say, does this solve our problems? Does this obviate the need for actually having a primordial noble gas signature in the mantle? because in a lot of cases, the low radiogenic to primordial ratios that we've been talking about, saying that these are the less degas signatures, that's also the direction you would go if you're mixing with atmosphere. And so you can ask, can differential recycling of atmospheric heavy noble gases explain the differences between plume and more noble gases? So this was suggested by Holland and Ballantyne in 2006, saying that the preferential incorporation of recycled atmospheric noble gases was what was driving low, for instance, xenon-129, that's radiogenic, to primordial-130 in plumes. So more regassing rather than less degassing in plumes. So this is a figure from a recent paper by Hilke Schlichting and Sujoy, showing helium and xenon primordial isotope ratio on the x-axis, atmospheres on the bottom left, and then your short-lived radiogenic xenon-129 to xenon-130. And it's showing two mantle source compositions. So this is an estimate of the MORB source from our famous popping rock from the North Atlantic, and then an estimate of the Icelandic plume mantle source. And so this is the composition of the atmosphere. If you were to start with a composition like the MORB source and preferentially regas more atmosphere, you'd be lying somewhere on this line. And we can see that the plume source is actually on a distinct line. So there's no way to take something like the upper mantle or the MORB source, preferentially regas more atmosphere into it, and then explain this composition. And vice versa is also true. You can't explain the MORB source and the plume source mutually just by regassing. Does that make sense? The other really important thing to note here is that it's iodine-129 that's causing variations in the y-axis here. And as I said, that's only alive for the first 90 million years of Earth history. So this has to be an ancient difference that got set up within the first 100 million years of Earth history and then not erased. And so you might look at this and you'd be like, okay, but this is a xenon-xenon isotope ratio, and this is helium-xenon. What if there's some funny degassing thing? I can get away from that if degassing were to somehow... Oh, yes, said that. Affect elemental ratios. We can see the same thing in just a pure three-isotope plot, xenon isotopes, on both axes. So now this is the short-lived iodine-produced 129 xenon. This is a fission isotope of xenon, primordial to fission isotope. And it's less important to sort of wrap your heads around what variation in the axes signifies. It's most important to see atmosphere is here, the Icelandic plume source up here, and then what we think is the Samoan plume source sampled at the Lau Basin, very close to Iceland. And then that equatorial Atlantic MORB source down to the bottom left. The Southwest Indian Ridge MORB source is kind of intermediate. There are interesting things happening there, and there are a lot of ideas bouncing around in my head what that might mean. But again, importantly, you can't start with something like the MORB source and preferentially regas to form a plume xenon budget. Does this make sense? Yeah.
What about if the atmosphere composition changed with time?
Wait 2 weeks. So we have a paper we've been working on that will be published, hopefully August 9th, looking into that. All right. So very quickly, if we can say that it's not regassing driving the differences between MORBs and plumes, can we say from xenon that it absolutely has to be degassing, and therefore there has to be a less degassed and therefore more primordial noble gas enriched mantle source? So the answer is yes, you can try to place constraints on the extent of degassing by looking at the ratio of plutonium fission to uranium fission derived xenon. And the way that this works, I'm going to have two conceptual mantle boxes, and each one has the identical starting composition of plutonium and uranium. And nothing about this is accurate, like the ratios aren't accurate. It's just a thought exercise. And on the left, I'm going to have no degassing. And on the right, I'm going to slowly degas my box. So because plutonium is relatively short-lived in my first time step, I've just converted all those plutoniums to little yellow xenons, and those will be my plutonium fission-derived xenons. So I've also got a little decay of the uranium. I've produced two or one each of the uranium fission xenon. And now as I go up through these time steps, you're seeing xenon disappear from the box on the right and uranium slowly decaying. So the overall extent is that as you degas the box on the right, you're losing both isotopes of xenon. The mantle doesn't care which xenon isotope it degasses, but you're only going to grow back the uranium fission xenon over time. And so at the end of this thought experiment, what we end up with is if you have a reservoir with less degassing, it has a high ratio of plutonium fission xenon to total fission xenon. And if you had more degassing, then you have a low ratio of this plutonium fission xenon in yellow to uranium fission xenon. Because again, you lost both types of xenon isotopes by degassing, but you only grew back the uranium fission xenon. So what does it look like if we actually look at our estimates of plutonium fission xenon to uranium fission xenon?
So I have a question.
Yeah.
Where's the fission coming from? Wouldn't the uranium be fissile only in the first 2 billion years history of the Earth? Or?
No. So uranium-238 undergoes spontaneous fission. So alpha decay is one branch and spontaneous fission is another. So every decay that it goes through, there's some probability of spontaneous fission, and that's true throughout time. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so if we look at the data for, this is averaged among our mid-ocean ridge basalt study areas and plume study areas, and I'm showing three dots. That's for three different models of the initial or the primordial mantle xenon. That's just to test the sensitivity to what if a primordial xenon was average carbonaceous chondrite, or solar wind, or this funny component called U-xenon, which is not uranium xenon, which we can pretty much overlook right now. The main point is that mid-ocean ridge basalt results all have low ratios of plutonium to total fission-derived xenon compared to plumes. And in some cases, the plumes are reflecting such high plutonium fission fractions that would be an almost undegas source. So the picture that we can paint just from these, from this analysis of the xenon isotopic composition is that you had to have two reservoirs that were distinct within 100 million years of the start of the solar system. They were never homogenized, which is not to say that they weren't mixed, right? That's a distinction. You could have mixing, but you can't homogenize them. Both of these incorporated significant amounts of recycled material. But differential regassing doesn't explain the differences between them. Instead, the MORB source is more degassed than the plume source based on these fission xenon isotopes. So sort of bringing this back to the sort of mantle arrays that Dominique was showing, if we're reconciling this new picture with these mantle mixing arrays, here I've shown this is a bunch of different ocean island chains in helium isotopes versus strontium isotopes. Less degassed helium is up. More degas is down. Depleted MORBs are over on this bottom left, enriched on the bottom right, and then I've labeled this PRIMA or FOSO. You've seen that a few times now. The sort of point that we'd like to make is that these mixing arrays trend towards a component with high helium-4-3. So it's not depleted, or it's not a degassed signature. It's a less degassed signature. So we have to hold that in our heads when we're thinking about our geodynamic models, that all these plumes have to be sampling something that has been less degassed. And I'll just address two sort of common alternatives that are brought up. Some have suggested that high helium-3-4 would actually, or could potentially, reflect helium-3 diffusion from the core, or having high helium-3 to uranium ratios frozen in from an ancient melting event. And we'd just like to point out that neither of these would explain the high plutonium fission fraction in plumes. So you would not have plutonium fission signature leaking out from the plumes if the helium-3 is diffusing from the core, and that would not be reconcilable with having ancient frozen melts with high helium 3 to uranium ratios. You need a difference in degassing to explain the plutonium fission fraction. And I'll stop there.
All right, let's try to do this really fast so we can go and have lunch, because I'm particularly hungry too. So remember about this diagram from the end of my talk. So it seems to be the large igneous provinces melted at hotter temperatures than ocean island basalts, but they all melted and have higher degrees of partial melted than ambient mantle. So this is what is telling us is that plumes are hot, but there are some sources of uncertainty here, significant sources of uncertainty. Do you remember what? What is the biggest source of uncertainty in this mantle potential temperature calculation from the tutorial? Nobody remembers? Or everybody remembers? Okay, there's water, okay? That's one source of uncertainty, like volatiles. We're assuming that these are dry melts. Melts from a relatively dry source. What else? There is another one, even more important, that can cause significant differences in temperature if you don't have a good way to constrain this.
Well, it was not in the tutorial, but maybe the major element composition of the source, like carbs and acrylic.
There is that. So that if you know, all these calculations are, you know, made on melts that we have a good idea that may potentially come from a peridotite source. But we may change those parameters in some years, and you know, all this could be wrong. There was one more thing, and it is the partition of iron 2 and iron 3 in the source, or the state of oxidation. You can have really big differences in temperature if you don't know what you're doing there. So another thermometer that exists out there that is based on the empirical calibration of experiments is what is called the aluminum enolivine crystallization thermometer. This thermometer is not giving you mantle temperatures. It's giving you the temperatures where those magmas crystallize. So keep that in your mind. But the difference is that this thermometer doesn't care if what melted was a peridotite, a peroxenite, or whatever. It doesn't matter if there is water or not in the source, because it's giving you a crystallization temperature. And the other thing that is really important is that, because these are all inclusions inside olivine, is not the variation of the state of oxidation is not going to matter here either. So we can use this thermometer to test if this is real. And what we did is, there's a beautiful, I think this is the first time we show a thin section of anything in this conference. So we have a nice crystal of olivine here, and these little inclusions here are spinel inclusions. So we can go and actually polish this crystal and go inside and try to reconstruct the temperatures by analyzing the olivine around the inclusion and apply that thermometer. So what I'm going to show you is a very similar analysis we did with large igneous provinces and also oceanic islands. But I'm going to include a new Komatii location that we rediscovered a couple of years ago. So what are Komatiites? Komatiites are remnants of hotter Earth. That's what you're supposed to say there. There is an artistic idea of an eruption of a Komatiite in the Archean. So during the Archean, this was painted by Claude Hirzberg, by the way. In the Archean, there were multiple of these massive eruptions of really hot material. They floated in the surface of the Earth at 1500 degrees, and they record really high mantle potential temperatures. So I'm going to throw some of these Komatiites there, given the fact that we rediscovered a new location that is only 90 million years old. So these are not Archean Komatiites, these are Phanerozoic Komatiites. All right, so this is stuck, so we're including this new place. Oh, and that's the result. I have a one-way diagram here showing again that large igneous provinces, or data from large igneous provinces, is way hotter than MORP. So the results we have for mantle potential temperatures continue telling us, this basically tells the same story, that melts that come from a plume source are hot. So they must come from very deep earth. But the other thing that is really interesting is that this new location we're including has really, really hot temperatures. This is telling us that this sample crystallized at 1550 degrees. And I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but what is the crystallization temperature of a Hawaiian lava? Ten degrees? 1100 degrees? What do you think? Dominique, what is your usual?
I'm not answering.
Okay.
It's not for me to answer.
Well, you're the closest to Hawaii person that we can find here.
Well, somebody
must know. So what is the what do you think? What is the temperature of crystallization of a basaltic melt? 1200 is very hot for a basalt. We're talking about these guys crystallized at 1500 degrees. So they record the same crystallization temperature than Archean comariates. And the Archean was a time of the year that the planet was really, really hot. So there is a problem of finding these today, or there is a problem of where, to solve this problem, we need to ask, where are they coming from? And we can go back to Rita's talk of maybe there are some reservoirs inside the planet that are keeping those temperatures, but I'm gonna get back to that. So, yeah?
How are the crystallization temperatures related to the source temperatures?
Okay, we can inverse. We can do an inversion for that. But I decided not to do it because I'm trying to take assumptions from this discussion. I'm just trying to show that things are hotter in plumes. But we can definitely do a projection. There are ways to do, but you need to make assumptions again. So the whole idea of showing that diagram is that without big assumptions, plumes still produce really hot magmas. And remember, mantle potential temperature depends on magnesium. This is what we did in the tutorial, so everybody here should be super excited about looking at this diagram. So for this new location, we basically record mantle potential temperatures in the order of 1800 degrees Celsius. That's really crazy. Something happened here because you have a PC. Yeah, so that should be North Atlantic Large Ignis Province. Basically, you can see that there is something really unusual about these samples. They're plotting within Archean comariates. And to basically correlate the two thermometers, we have the aluminum and olivine. This is the experimental calibration. And we have the mantle potential temperature. This is the one that you learn to calculate. We have a really decent correlation. Those are not error bars. That's just the standard deviation of the data of all the different groups. But again, this correlation is telling us that MORP is down here, low temperature, low crystallization temperatures, low mantle potential temperatures. Iceland is slightly hotter. Iceland is probably not super hot because it's close to a mid-ocean ridge. And then when we move in this direction, we get to really, really hot temperatures in range with Archean comariates. So how can we explain that 90 million years ago, we have an eruption of a really, really hot lava? It makes absolutely no sense. We spent years, this is a really long story, that probably everybody's hungry to go into that, but the deal is that this is a really robust measurement. So we know that there is this correlation between mantle plumes and the edges of the LLSVP. So, and we also have seismic evidence of that we can trace down the source of plumes all the way to the core mantle boundary. All right, Rita presented some data that shows that there are these really old anomalies inside the planet that were formed really early, and that's basically what this tungsten correlation with helium is showing too. So geochemistry is telling us that there are these deep reservoirs that potentially, not potentially, that are preserving these really ancient anomalies. So the way I would like to explain this is that potentially during the Archean, we have a lot of mantle plumes bringing materials from the core mantle boundary. And that's why we have a lot of these comariates, because the mantle was hotter, there was more mantle plume activity, so the possibility of sampling this was higher than the possibility or the probability we have today of sampling these deep air reservoirs. And today, the mantle cooled down. We still preserve anomalies in the deep earth that are not only as, you know, what this data is showing you is that there is not only a geochemistry signal, there's a temperature signature that is still there. That means that whatever is happening here is not mixing very efficiently with the rest of the mantle. And how I explain this, there's two ways. One is that the crystallization of the core is buffering temperatures at the core mantle boundary. That's one possibility. We can talk about that. I talked with Kanani, and she told me that this makes no sense. But we can discuss this a little bit more later, maybe in the way to the dining facility. Another interesting possibility is that we still have remnants of the magma ocean sitting at the ultra-low velocity provinces. And if that's possible, then the remnant of a magma ocean is still going to buffer temperatures, and maybe we can preserve some of those isotopic signatures also here. And I think with that, we're done with the chemistry. Any questions? Or we want to run back? Yes, there's one in the back there.
So which LSVP Saint Tortugal is associated with?
I would say that this is the Pacific, because it's related with the Galapagos plume.
It's Galapagos plume?
Yes.
But you're saying that they're sampling... I may be misinterpreting or adding an extra step. Are you saying these plumes are associated with LSVPs?
I didn't hear what you said, man.
Are you saying the plumes are associated with LSVPs?
With the LLSVP, yes.
Yes. But the Galapagos isn't over the Pacific LSVP, is it?
Yes, it is. There is an edge, a little bit of an edge, that it depends on the tomography and the way you squint your eyes, you can you can associate it.
Okay.
Yes. Because tectonics was really good with us and gave us slivers of the oceanic plateau. So we're being able to sample sections of an oceanic plateau that are not accessible. Like that's my interpretation. Like if we take the Onton Java plateau and we slide it and we go and take chunks from, we probably will get things like this too. Yeah. All right, let's go and have lunch.